welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery.
Ta-da.
Yeah, they're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And if you need a new mower or a new tractor or implements or pretty much anything ag-related, go up and see them. They can fix you up. If they don't have it, they know where to get it. They've got over 110 locations to draw from, so if they don't have it in stock, they can get on the phone and find it and get it in there for you. So go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They've got great financing, 0% up to 84 months on tractors and mowers. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. Thanks for the hand signals, because I was really getting confused
hand signals
without them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the phone number?
Yeah.
That was pretty helpful,
yeah,
wasn't it?
That was very helpful.
I thought it was super helpful.
I knew I could count on you. Aaron.
Bill. So free advertisement of the day goes to... I know you thought it was going to be the tiny chainsaw at Pape Machinery.
No.
Okay, that was pretty great.
That was pretty great.
You'll have to listen to the last hour for that. But Hilltop Diner. I was
at Hilltop Diner again
the other day. I had something different than I had had before. And I don't know why they don't have a 1,000 people outside waiting to get in. Their food's awesome.
Yeah, you can get in and sit down and get served right away, too. It's not a jam-packed situation. It will be, because people listen to this show, they're going to go in there and get a great meal.
Their beef comes from R&R Meats.
Yep,
I mean, their meat's really good quality. All their stuff is fresh. And they have really good cookies, too. I learned about those.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They have a macadamia white chunk strawberry something or other. And yeah, we had a little accident with the cookies.
Did they identify as pie? Because they do have pie there.
Bill's baiting me. Okay, last week while we were, we'll just tattle. So we had this pie baking contest where we live last weekend. So I decided I was taking cookies because, I don't know, I just seemed like a pain in the rear to make pie. So I took cookies. But I put them in my mother-in-law's pie dish that's kind of fancy. You know, it's glass. It looks like a pie dish, obviously.
It's quality pie dish.
So I thought, hey, I'm going to put cookies in the pie dish. That's funny. And then I was like, no, I'm going to put a note with the cookies in the pie dish. And so my note, beautifully written, said, these cookies identify as delicious pie. And I was just so surprised we didn't win the pie baking contest.
I know.
I thought it was wrong.
Yeah.
Most people thought it was funny. There were two ladies, though. They went over, and one looked at the other one. I could see her talking because they didn't know who brought it. And she's like, who would do this? We're new.
Oh, it's the new people.
It was the new lady. Yeah, so anyway, there you go. Full disclosure. That's what we were doing last week while we were playing a replay on Memorial Day. Oh, my gosh. So, Nathan, where the heck were we before we played the song? I'm sure George Harrison really should sue this guy. But when mighty glaciers weep, huh?
Yeah. No, I think we were talking about the energy, green energy situation in California. And on the break, we were talking about how California, I mean, they are headed for a huge train wreck. And nobody seems to really be too concerned about it. But they're forcing everybody to buy electric cars, and I think that's coming in 2035 or something. You'll no longer be able to buy
a gas-powered car.
Everybody has to buy electric. And then they've done nothing to really beef up our power grid. They put in no new hydro. They've done nothing there. And last year, they were telling people with electric cars, please don't charge during these hours because there's going to be possible brownouts. Well, we already are short, and they're pushing everybody towards this green energy. And as you were saying, our grid is not built for that. I mean, during peak times, there's going to be rolling brownouts, and it's going to get worse. We were talking about Texas. It happened to them in the wintertime. People were freezing to death because they put a lot of eggs in the solar or in the wind power, and the turbines all froze and stopped working. And, oh, gosh, there's no electricity in the wintertime. Yeah, who could have saw that coming? But California is still marching towards that same direction, and it's going to happen here. It's going to be really bad.
It's going to be heinous. With all this crazy rulemaking that you're watching, Nathan, do you see? Are you looking into that, or is it kind of like, are you confined for the time being to land use?
Well, my main focus tends to be land use and our natural resource issues, but another area that is a part that I track regularly and a part of the connections I make is from the economic front. So I track a little bit and kind of keep up to date on some of those items, especially the energy front, because energy, I mean, ultimately, even wind and solar, all that, I mean, wind, it takes ground. It's something called power density. There's an equation for how much land it takes to generate a kilowatt hour of electricity. And wind and solar have horrible power density compared to traditional sources of energy. In other words, it takes way more land for wind and solar to get the equivalent of kilowatt hour power delivered onto the grid. You know, so I track and understand it from those perspectives. I guess a lot of what I try to do is to connect those dots between the fact that our land use policy is a directly affected or vice versa on the energy markets and the issues we face, like California going with electric cars and whatnot. You know, they say they want to force everybody to drive electric cars, but the fact of the matter is if they succeed, they're going to force a small amount of people to drive electric cars while the rest of the people are forced into alternative public modes of transportation, because that's just based on the fact that the material resources that they're locking up in our country from being able to even mine and access at the current rate don't even get close to meeting the demand for what they are arbitrarily pushing for. And that's why, as an Austrian economic framework, where I hold to, that's why government shouldn't be in the position of setting prices and driving market investment. That should be something that is dealt with in the free market enterprise, back to what I was alluding to earlier, because then individuals suffer the losses of their risk, and they're not able to directly pass that on to the taxpayer. And therefore, they're also much more efficient in the development of new techniques and investment into new technology that allows us to progress and be more efficient and actually maintain the standard of living that we have created through private property and the means of production. So in those senses, that's part of my vision, is connecting. I don't track as much and get involved policy-wise on the electric car stuff and those spectrums, but I do track it in the context of connecting it to the issues we face in our natural resource industries, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense, because obviously you can't watch everything, but there's massive amounts of overlap on all this. And I guess that's the part that can't be overstated. These things are all connected. This isn't happening in a vacuum. They don't want to just mess up a little something over here and a little something over there. Maybe hit a little bit more on what you're seeing on the wider policy front, especially with this, the bureaucrats wanting to do a bunch of rulemaking. Because we started with rulemaking and then we derailed you. Go back to that.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. That's actually a perfect lead-in to touch on a couple things.
2 points
that
for me.
You always have things you want to say on a program, and then usually you don't say them.
because people like me who derail you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is all right. I mean, that's part of the nice thing about having free dialogue and coming together and having a discussion, is you also end up saying things that should have been said that you didn't plan on saying. So I'm going to just real briefly here walk through something that's fresh on my desk that I've been looking at to connect. So let me start with this. So Bureau of Land Management, early April, promulgated a rule to revise the regulations for land use planning processes under the Federal Land Policy Management Act to place conservation leasing and permitting on par with domestic livestock grazing and oil and gas leasing and the other leases and permits that have traditionally existed under the Federal Land Policy Management Act. So that would essentially make bring conservation to the level. And what they mean by conservation is a third-party interest that buys and has control of a deeded land that's connected with, and for your listening audience, a lot of federal lands in the West, like with ranching lands, for example, there's private land that the rancher lives on, and then his land is connected and dependent on a federal or public lands, and they lease that for the domestic livestock interest of that private producer. They're called dependent commensurate properties. So this landscape conservation health rule that BLM is putting forward would allow, for instance, organization like American Prairie Reserve, who is buying up ranches, those private deeded lands with those connections to public land leases, they then could apply to the Bureau of Land Management for a conservation permit that would allow them to utilize that federal land under a non-use paradigm, remove the livestock grazing. In case they put bison out there as wild animals and take out all the fencing and whatnot. But so with that said, that is a rule that's being promulgated by Department of Interior through Bureau of Land Management, and that rule would touch 230-plus million acres that's under their administrative jurisdiction. So that's problematic in and of itself, but that's the rule that's coming forward. There's no authority in statute for them to do this. It's been shot down by the courts in relationship to the grazing regulations in the past. In 2000, the courts said the Secretary of Interior lacked the statutory authority to issue grazing permits for conservation use, which is non-use. See, right now, the federal government functions under a use-or-lose policy. So if I'm not putting cattle on my grazing lease, I lose it, and somebody else has the opportunity to run cattle on that permit or lease. That's how the current framework is. So this conservation leasing rule would upend that whole framework and allow special interests to buy up land and then apply for conservation leases. And then that connects to the 30 by 30 initiative, which calls for tying up 30% of lands and waters into permanent conservation. So
what's the percentage now? Like, what kind of a change would that be? Ballpark.
You know, that's a really good question, and that should be a number that I have on the
right there in front of me.
I don't have the percentage. I know there's a percentage out there, and I have it written somewhere.
That's okay. I just was curious if that was something you'd come across, because I'm thinking 30%, that's a lot. And then, of course, the next thing on my mind was, well, what is it now?
Yeah, it would be significant. There's already quite a bit of land in national parks, as we were discussing earlier, that's already tied up to some extent or another in refuges and national parks, monuments. And so this administration is doing two things. They're expanding the existing frameworks to tie up more lands. But this new rule that's coming out of Bureau of Land Management is creating a whole new mechanism. It functions similar to what perpetual or conservation easements do, except for it's applied to federal lands. And opens up this whole new arena of economic activity. And so that's the problem. So a little bit of a background on this. The environmentalists and scientists have advocated for biodiversity and biological conservation to be the primary goal of domestic public land management and policies. And that has been done through the 90s and up through the thousands. And I will make the note that through all that time, Congress has not acted in drafting a body of law that delegates executive branch to focus primarily on biological conservation. So as a result, the environmental community has more and more called for an ever-increasing role of the executive branch to implement biodiversity conservation initiatives through discretionary measures, which is straying farther and farther away from clearly delegated authorities. So the economic connection here, or go ahead if you're going to say something.
Oh, no, but nice timing, though, on that, just because we need to take a quick break. So, well, we've interrupted your thought process by thinking it. That's pretty good. We ESP'd you. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, I just try to make believe that everything you're telling me is true. Come on, baby, won't you do?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana message. Don't buy the corporate marijuana lies whose end game is to not pay any taxes. California has failed to control the grows. Dispensaries are selling out the back door as well as selling other illicit substances. Do we really need the damage to the environment, suicide, schizophrenia, hyperemesis, cardiac events in elderly users, drug driving crashes, genetic damage, pulmonary damage, neonatal low birth weight, and lost IQ for our youth? No, we don't. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
Yeah, I was in a quandary there on that song. Couldn't decide if I should play that one or Dude Looks Like a Lady. Those were my choices. 540 songs, and what am I looking at? Little Red Riding Hood or Dude Looks Like a Lady? Terrible. Nathan, back to you. Save me from myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to summarize, I guess, on the leasing rule and to the background there, in the 90s, Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt placed biodiversity conservation at the center of Department of Interior's mission for public lands management. And so just before that is when President Clinton signed the Biodiversity Convention in 1993, which was developed at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro. But the Senate never acted to advise or ratify the convention. So subsequently, the environmental community has failed to adequately demonstrate that such commitments to biodiversity conservation is anything more than mere rhetoric. And that's evidenced by the fact that Congress over the last 25-plus years has not enacted any laws which authorize, let alone require, far-reaching biodiversity conservation measures. So in other words, under the Biodiversity Convention, they got some things done and they pushed pretty hard, but they never really had the success they wanted. Because ultimately the Senate never did ratify that convention. So now, coming into the modern era of land use planning, what's happening is the environmental community is now pushing for more executive bureaucracy activity to implement biodiversity conservation initiatives. So with the inception of the Paris Accord, what the environmental community is now doing is creating a natural asset class to connect to biodiversity conservation.
Ooh.
That's the economic elements that are coming into play in this process. And you may be familiar, some of your listeners familiar with what's happening in the international finance realm and the White House issuing documents to create a natural asset class And that ties into your carbon markets and other things. But this also links to this conservation leasing rule. And so this current rule seeks to establish administrative mechanisms in order to facilitate artificial avenues for private investments into natural resource lands without the extractive material products to attach a value to. So that will create an illusion of private market value for the application of non-use of lands, which then will be sold and marketed into the international finance realm as a natural asset class to be purchased by large regulated corporations as a carbon credit to offset their emissions. By the way, this will all be done with no calculable benefits to local governments and citizens. So interestingly enough, basically you'll have, as a result of this rule, in my opinion, if it gets promulgated, the connection to these asset classes that allow corporations, basically in religious terminology, to pay their indulgences.
Sure.
You know, I'm gonna use oil and gas for my purposes, and I'll buy these credits developed by these third party entities applying conservation leases on public lands and creating a economic framework. So this is a very, very dangerous trajectory on the leasing and permitting of our public lands, especially when, and the reason I connect it, just to verify this, to the natural asset class aspect is because the White House published a document early this year called the White House Natural Capital Accounting Strategy, which places conservation as an economic necessity. So these processes seek to arbitrarily place a value on non-use of public lands and then inventory them under the 30 by 30 conservation objectives. The White House document I just mentioned on in Section E, page 12, specifically states, quote, "The planned Conservation Stewardship Atlas," and that's the inventorying tool they're creating, "will function as a tool for tracking a range of conservation benefits provided by U.S. lands and waters, particularly for biodiversity, climate, and equity benefits." So the conservation leasing rule creates a regulatory framework for Department of Interior to transition lands from use to non-use. And the Conservation Stewardship Atlas is the inventorying mechanism that they track that transition. And then they pass that inventory over to the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department, who then compiles those inventories on Article 4, 7, and 14 of the Paris Accord and delivers that as a contribution to our nationally determined contributions biannually as a global stock take for carbon emission reductions. Because under those nationally determined contributions, land use is included for those decarbonization objectives. Mm-hmm. So these conservation leases, and by the way, everything I just said, those dots I connected, you're not going to see those things on the Federal Register relating to this rule. But the same departments that issued the nationally determined contribution that says we're going to follow the guidance for the IPCC and the CMA annexes that were developed in these international conventions are the same departments that are issuing these rules and regulatory rewrites to transition our lands into conservation status. And then you have the Conservation Stewardship Atlas, which was developed pursuant to the 30 by 30 initiative, to inventory that transition, track it, and report it to the international community as a nationally determined contribution. Some people are connecting those dots, but I would submit to you and your audience that if we don't start recognizing how the international climate agenda is driving domestic policy, we're not going to be able to deal with what's actually happening through these federal departments.
Unbelievable.
And Congress needs to get involved, in my opinion, because they have jurisdiction in Article 1 over international contexts such as what I'm bringing forward.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's like anything else. You get so much stuff happening all at the same time, and it's extremely difficult to keep your eye on all the plates that are spinning above your head. And I think that's what these guys count on. You know?
Well, absolutely. I call it a blitzkrieg of administrative rulemaking. And that's what the blitzkrieg in Germany was all about, is, you know, you show up with such, it's all at once.
Right,
we're bringing
right.
all the ammunition, all the tanks, all the hard armory, and we're there before you can even respond. So we have this administrative blitzkrieg. It's not hard armor and tanks and weapons. It's administrative bureaucrats in swivel chairs pumping out rules through federal departments that is fundamentally transitioning the economic and governmental processes that traditionally we've lived under, which is very problematic. And that's why it's causing economic confusion. It's causing inflation and a whole host of other things. And we can't continue down that pathway. And they do that on purpose. One of the only reasons I'm able to bring some of these things forward is because I've personally made this a priority of my desk. I have a document that I'm actually have finished it's and brought it forward in January that I'm going to be more broadly disseminating, and it's called All Roads Lead to Paris. And it's a chronology that tracks the administrative process under Executive Orders 13990 and 1408 of how those branches and departments are implementing those international timetables and objectives. So the reason I have some level of subject matter expertise on these connections is because I've spent the last 2 years since those orders hit the Federal Register tracking that, reading the documents. So now it's the process that I'm working on now and working with different individuals in doing so is to connect those dots. Because there's Administrative Procedures Act violations of these departments that are not being transparent on the Federal Register with how they're really going to be utilizing these rules that will create administrative mechanisms for agencies to transition lands away from use to non-use, and how that connects to international timetables and objectives that the Congress hasn't spoken on.
Yeah. Well, I know that that the focus after this this bill last week was to put them back on regular order for appropriations, and in there, that would give us some ability finally to get back to taking money away from these guys for these purposes, provided that they're watching it.
Exactly. There's a lot, and it's sad that the way that all went through. Probably there was a lot of compromise, I think, that is allowing kind of a blank check to go out there at this point. We'll see how it all shakes up at the end of the day. But
well, that was kind of the talking point, but there were like 12 members of the Republican Party that were willing to sign on with the Democrats to pass a clean bill out of the House, meaning no limits whatsoever. So
yeah.
They could have wound up with zilch. Fighting the debt ceiling next year made no sense. It's the same configuration. Democrats control the Senate and the White House, so why would you fight it again next year? But that isn't a spending bill. That's not a budget bill. So, you know, I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion about how they got this blank check, but that's not how money is spent. Money is spent through appropriation. So now, if they don't stick to the limits that were in that bill, automatic sequestration kicks in. And that was kind of like the subtext that nobody really read, but they don't get to spend whatever they want. That isn't how that works. So I'm kind of looking forward to appropriation, because when that comes, then all of this crazy climate stuff and all that is a place we can reel some of it back. But there's no way that they were going to get big cuts through the Senate and through the White House on last week's bill. They were lucky to get anything.
Yeah, well, and so another thing potentially that the Congress could do, so there's a body of law out there. It's called the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And that body of law provides congressional and Senate oversight over discretionary committees. And discretionary committees are committees that are set up by federal departments to advise them in their rulemaking processes. So like all this climate stuff I've been talking about of what the agencies are doing,
right.
The first thing they did under Executive Order 1408 is they set up the National Climate Task Force, which is made up of the department heads of many of these federal departments. And that's the task force that's advising the Secretary of Interior, developing the nationally determined contributions, and providing advisory and driving the rulemaking processes for the climate policy objectives. So under FACA, there's standing committees that have oversight over these committees, the discretionary committees, and I don't know if where those standing committees are, if they're even active or who is on them and whatnot, but that's something most definitely that needs to be, and I'm working on projects that are looking into bringing that forward and getting some congressional oversight, because FACA gives the Congress to abolish committees if they deem them to be unnecessary or illegitimate. And so some potentials there where not only dealing with the funding to these departments, but there's some of these discretionary committees like the National Climate Task Force and other committees that have been established by Deb Haaland and other departments that the Congress could potentially rein in. But it takes people from the ground and local governments feeding the information to our congressmen to inform them and give them the tools they need and the information and data to apply and maybe leverage that and do something about on those, or to get rid of those committees or to rein them in if possible.
Oh yeah, like the groups that you're working with. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you keep us in the loop on that, because we'd love to pass that along. That would be that'd be a really useful thing, especially when all of this budgeting stuff is coming. You have deadlines for that coming by the end of July, actually. The only way they can be on a budget is if they get that. And then we don't have to deal with the omnibus bill and all that stuff at the end of the year, which would be obviously much better. Much better way to spend money, much better way to control it, and potential to reel in the spending, thank God. We have to take a really quick break, and then we will come right back. This will be our break with kind of grumpy songs, and then I'm saving the best for last. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. Without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much. For good.
That could be your theme song, Nathan. Oh my goodness. It does seem like a lot of this is just taking off without us a little bit. I mean, I don't know. It feels like it has sped up. How about that?
Yeah. Well, and you know, in many ways it has, but you know, I was just reading this morning in a book that was written by, I believe it was written by Philippe de Mornay, one of the French Huguenots, in some of the darker times in France in the 1500s, published originally in the later 1500s. But it's a book that's called, and our founding fathers read and looked to this pretty significantly in their thinking. The title of it is A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants. And there's a section in that book, the title is, If the Prince May Make New Laws. And that's exactly what we're dealing with this BLM rule and a lot of things being promulgated by the executive department. See, the executive department is there to execute existing law, not make new law. And this book deals with that. And I just want to read just this short little piece here out of it, because he deals with that question. If the prince may make new laws, he says, what then? Shall it not be lawful for a prince to make new laws and abrogate the old, seeing it belongs to the king not only to advise that nothing be done neither against nor to defraud the laws, but also that nothing be wanting to them nor anything too much in them, briefly, that neither age nor lapse of time do abolish or entomb them. If there is anything to abridge, to be added or taken away from them, it is his duty to assemble the estates and to demand their advice and resolution, without presuming to publish anything before the whole have been duly examined and approved by them. That sounds a whole lot like laws promulgated by the just consent of the people, which is in the Declaration of Independence of our country. So Philip de Mornay, 500 years ago nearly, as a French Huguenot suffering administrative central control and power in the church-state system of France at the time, which was squashing the freedom of conscience, the freedom of religion, and the